Mayor Wolf, as Toronto's new acting mayor, can you comment on some of the allegations about your personal life?
I get plenty of Nobody should be worried about how much I get.
Can you say something about the charges that you've used crocodile, an injectable opioid made from codeine, paint thinner, iodine, and red phosphorus from matches?
I totally f***ed that.
How about the story in TMZ that you and Chris Brown on a pregnant...
Frankly, I would have to have so much in my system to even be able to f*** that.
Mayor Wolf, could you please say something that we can use in our newscast that is not laced with obscenities and these images that people will not be able to get out of their heads?
Well, I really do think we need to start fixing some of those potholes. That's good, right? That's a mayor thing, right? Today, our culture panel, The Nose, tackles another crazy week in the life of America and Canada. And now he would give anything to be able to tell his grandkids Alec Baldwin screamed a homophobic slur at him. Colin McEnroe.
And I probably will. If I hang around long enough, it'll happen. It seems to happen to absolutely everybody. Actually, we're not going to be talking about Rob Ford today. We sort of used misdirection. That was us getting Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, out of our systems because we just don't want to. And there's almost no way to talk about this anyway. So joining us today for The Nose from Trinity College, Professor Luis Figueroa from Trinity Cine Studio, with a big Trinity theme going here, James Hanley, and from Tuxas Community College, Professor Elizabeth Kiefer.
Go Tuxas.
All right. That's who's here. We're going to spend the second segment of our show talking about an article that's in today's New York Times. We'll sort of build out from there. But it's about the effort to preserve but yet keep from the public the pink suit, the kind of iconic pink suit that Jacqueline Kennedy was wearing on the day of her husband's assassination. But before we get to that, and we'll talk about that in a way that has sort of implications for modern life and history and all kinds of stuff. Before we get to that, though, we have some stories about race. That'll be our first segment. We're talking a little bit about race. We're going to begin with a column by Richard Cohen. You may have already seen some discussion of this somewhere. It was all over the internet this week and all over the late night comedy shows, at least on Colbert and on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show. This is Richard Cohen. He's actually was writing a column about Chris Christie's electoral profile, national electoral profile, post-gubernatorial win in New Jersey, how he would play in Iowa, what people would think about him if he ran as a national Republican candidate. And he went down a little side road. And at one point he wrote, "Today's GOP is not racist, as Harry Belafonte alleged about the Tea Party, but it is deeply troubled about the expansion of government, about immigration, about secularism, about the mainstreaming of what used to be avant-garde. People with conventional views must repress a gag reflex when considering the mayor-elect of New York, a white man married to a black woman and with two biracial children. Parentheses. Should I mention that Bill de Blasio's wife, Shirlane McRae, used to be a lesbian," close parentheses. "This family represents the cultural changes that have enveloped parts but not all of America. To cultural conservatives, this doesn't look like their country at all." When I first read that, I thought maybe that parentheses was even sort of a conversation that he was having with his editor that he didn't mean to get into the paper. But the larger question, of course, was, is this an appropriate characterization of anybody's attitudes? And to what degree has Richard Cohen kind of kicked a whole series of tripwires here? A lot of people have read this column a lot of different ways. Cohen is a very prominent columnist for The Washington Post, but a guy who gets himself in a lot of trouble, too. He sort of specializes in going there. He's a nominally a liberal or left of center columnist, but he's always kind of going off into these areas where he's almost afflicting the sensibilities of both conservatives and the people who ideally would be his readers. But so, James Hanley, I'll sort of let you start things off. Where did your mind go as you processed all this?
Well, I thought when I saw that, I thought I can see the editorial meeting where they thought about jacking up the views online. That it's a provocation to me. I mean, I don't think it's a meaningless thing to say, a deliberate provocation to me, that it really is something that certainly gets him discussed and gets people sort of deciding, as we are, you know, okay, well, this is an issue to discuss. And actually, there are issues to discuss about it. But it has all kinds of hidden buzzwords in it that really irritate me, things like conventional, you know, conventional views and the traditional and those words that always ring bells and raise red flags for me, that somehow everything everybody is doing in a progressive nature, like understanding how different people are or understanding different cultures or accepting that actually same-sex couples might actually like to have a life together, All of those things are somehow out there, and these are offenses against the conventional. And that was the sort of subtext of it. But I also think it's a cynical exploitation. I think his writing, I think that's why he's there, is to generate that kind of controversy that gets page views.
By the way, if you want to comment on this, don't dally, because we tend to jump from thing to thing. And so if you've been thinking about Richard Cohen and his column all week, give us a call right now, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, or risk being left behind as we flit from topic to topic. But Elizabeth Cover, I mean, Richard Cohen has really been pilloried this week, and we considered playing the Stephen Colbert takedown of him, which goes on at quite some length and is just merciless. But in a lot of sectors, he's been pilloried for his choice of words, his choices of imagery, his assertions about the attitudes of people, not himself, but people unlike him, but his claim about what they believe and what makes them gag. I don't know, did he deserve the punishment he got?
I read it differently, as I said in an email to all of you. I saw it as him saying there are a probably pretty big number of people, a large number of people, who would react that way to the mayor's family. And to me, it didn't really bother me. I said he's stirring the pot, and it gets us discussing this and what we should be discussing, what we shouldn't be discussing. And I also made the point that I think we tend to forget that liberals and conservatives are on a spectrum, and that we can slide around on that spectrum as it comes to each issue. And I don't think there's one way of looking at things as a liberal or as a conservative. I think we're allowed to feel what we feel with every new topic. So to me, he's not really bothering me with that. I felt like he really was saying, here's how some people would look at it.
In some ways, the point that he's making, part of the point that he's making, is the way that things look to us. Like, you know, a lot of us look at the first family of New York City and we think this is an incredibly cool looking family, and the son with a haircut, and everybody loves this. Some of the point that he's making is it'll play a little bit differently in Iowa. But as James is suggesting, some of the words that he chose were kind of loaded. They were tripwires. I don't know, Luis, where did your thoughts go?
Well, I think that, I mean, because I also read the article in the Huffington Post where he defends himself.
Right.
And he says, well, look at the whole column. This is just a little passage in the column. And I said that other people are the ones, it's not me who have these views and so on. But I think there are a couple of things that we need to take into consideration. The first one is that he has a track record of saying things that are rather offensive on issues of race. I'll just cite the one where he was sympathetic to the Zimmerman in the Trayvon Martin case, but other expressions that he has made. In fact, Colbert, in his segment, in one of the funniest parts of the segment, he says, well, that comment was only in parentheses, so it doesn't mean anything. So now I'm going to say something in parentheses. Mm-hmm. And it is, to me, that was the funniest part. But I think that there's an issue of his Cohen's track record. But also I think that we have to take into consideration the fact that a lot of times people say things that express ideas or images that they have inside of them that oftentimes they self-repress. Because there might not be appropriate or politically correct or whatever it might be in the context in which they're thinking or what they're writing about. And they come out oftentimes as statements that they attribute to others. But in this case, it's a very powerful metaphor about gag reflex. This is not something that you can just as easily come up with. So to me, there is a deep spring water coming out of his self-repressed views on some of these things. And I think that's an angle that I'd like to explore later.
Yeah, he ends his column talking about, just to do what Richard Cohen wants us to do and talk about the entire column. He ends his column, though, talking about, in fact, this live performance on YouTube of Merle Haggard singing "Are the Good Times Really Over?" This chestnut, a lament for a lost America, has been viewed well more than 2 million times. It could be the Tea Party's anthem, he says. Although, the one thing that struck me about this, and I did read this over a few times, is he's kind of almost missing the real drift of social change. The real drift of social change often does come from exactly the thing that he says makes people gag. My first thought reading the column, of course, was Clarence Thomas, who is as close to a black conservative icon as there is married to a white woman. But more than that, this is one of the ways that our ideas do change. They tend to change less through abstract statements about what's just and what's fair, and more from direct contact with happy families who are of mixed race or who are gay and lesbian. In other words, that's kind of what has been happening over the last 10 to 15 years. To whatever degree attitudes have changed, they've changed not because the sight of happy people in an unfamiliar configuration makes us want to gag, but it actually, you know, when you sort of encounter it on television, we had a guest earlier this week talking about just the incredible influence of The Cosby Show, the influence of Will and Grace in changing American attitudes. It seems like that's what does change people. It doesn't make them want to gag. It makes them think, oh, now it's not just this weird abstraction. I can actually see human beings here doing this thing, and it doesn't bother me so much.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that that's actually what's really going on, that there is that kind of change taking place. But at the same time, there's kind of this, like, constantly, even in places where things have changed, like in Connecticut, there'll be a periodic announcement by some people who are uncomfortable with the changes that have taken place socially, and they raise it as though, you know, what about the, it's sort of like the good old days argument, you know, when young people used to respect adults or something like that, you know, that this is somehow you know, that it's a call to the past, that somehow we knew how to do things better. And those are signals to people, and in a political environment where people are running for things and they're actually, you know, like you want to know, you know, what does this person believe and what would they do if they got into office? Those things do matter. I mean, change does happen, certainly, but I think that when signals are sent to people, I mean, I think that gag reflex thing, rightly, that's a really, the gag reflex thing contains lots of undercurrents to
exactly.
It. It's very visceral.
Yeah. yes, there are all kinds of implications, but if I could interject something here quick, is that you know, the comment that some people made in other places, Slate and some other places I read, was that the accusation against Cohen was that he was unfair to the Tea Party, to conservatives, because not all of them are necessarily racist, and they're citing polls where 87% of Americans support interracial relationships or whatever. But what is interesting on the other side of the fence is that there's increasingly scholarship coming out that deals with the ways in which the, some of Tea Party activists on that side of the Republican Party do talk about issues of race, and issues of race bother them, but that the way in which they come across are not necessarily talking about race directly, but about all the things. And I would just mention quickly, there is a Harvard sociologist, very prominent Harvard sociologist, Theda Keshbol. There's an interview with her that appeared a month ago in Salon, where she's talking about this research that she's doing. And part of it shows that there are deep anxieties in important segments of the country because they have been left behind in the technological and economic changes taking place in this country, but also they are afraid of how the country is changing in all kinds of respects. And one of the changes, besides the issue of gay marriage and more acceptance of homosexuality, has to do with immigration and has to do with race. And I think that's why I think that there's something underneath Richard Cohen's comment that go beyond simply saying that this is just a passage in the article.
And how many people are answering those polls that way because that's the politically correct way? And if you really could get them on a polygraph test, they might have a very, very much more complex.
I mean, they're focused research where there's different context, not a survey, when a lot of these things actually do come out.
Well, let's go to the story of somebody who does answer those polls in a very different way. He's 62 years old. His name is Craig Cobb. He is essentially a self-proclaimed white supremacist and separatist. He follows something called the creator religion, which favors racial awareness. He's been attempting to create a white enclave in North Dakota by quietly buying up land in the small town of Leith, despite anti-racism rallies and town meetings against his plans. I think also he has been involved, I don't have this in front of me right now, in harassing interracial couples.
That's right.
So he went on something, I've never heard of the show before, but it's called Trisha Goddard's Race in America series. It's some kind of television show. And one of the things that he did, it's something that I've done, he underwent a DNA test to look at his genetic heritage. We actually have the audio of him getting the results to his DNA test.
So Craig Cobb. Craig Paul Cobb has undergone DNA testing to determine genetic ancestry. 86% European, and...
Give it to him. Give it to him.
14% sub-Saharan African.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Hey.
Hold on.
So.
This is called statistical noise.
Sweetheart, you have a little black in you.
Yes, right?
All right, so that's Craig Cobb getting the news that he's 14. Let's round it up to 15% sub-Saharan African genetically. So, Elizabeth Kiefer, I'll let you kick off this discussion.
Well, first of all, is this not karma? Okay. And secondly, I hope he gets 40. He claims the test is flawed and it's short science, whatever that means. And he's going to go get tested 3 more times, I think he said. I hope he gets tested 42 more times and they all come out the same. Because this is the definition of karma coming back to you.
You know, you can't always get what you want. Well, actually, James, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that this whole thing about, you know, who, what identity is. I mean, this really puts into relief how absolutely absurd the whole nature of your genetic identity is. And it's actually, there's a movement now for amongst a certain group of people to publish their genetic codes online and make them widely available around the world. I think it's just starting here, but it's very big in England already.
Now, way of exposing people or just a way?
No, just the people volunteer to have their genetic, have a complete genome analysis and to publish it. Because one of the things behind it is this idea that you find out lots of things you should know anyway about your background. We learn about each other. And we also begin to debunk this whole nature of what exactly is race, that actually the mixture of human beings is so complex that it's absurd that it's more about people's behavior and their attitudes. And like this guy is saying, you know, he's for white supremacy, which is a political view that he sees as a way of achieving hegemony for his little plan. But it doesn't bear any relationship to his real identity. And the hope is that real identity might actually cause some people to think twice before they expose themselves.
This I want to go to Luis on this because it plays so well into some of the research he himself does and some of the interest that he really has in kind of the notion of how we construct our racial or ethnic identity. Before that, I just want to quickly share that I've had, of course, all three of the panelists know my son. My son is ethnically Mexican, whatever that means. And we have a lot of conversations about what does that probably mean? What does it mean that he's Mexican? What is it, you know, what would play into that? What constitutes a Mexican identity? And to what degree would that be indigenous peoples who were there before the Spanish? Blah, 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 blah. But so I had a similar test to what Mr. Cobb had through 23andMe. And before that, whenever we'd had these conversations, I had always said, I'm sure I'm part African American. It just, you know, what I know of my parents' heritage would just suggest that there would be plenty of room for that kind of a blip. You know, I know that if I'm ever tested, I'll be partly African American, and I look forward to that. And so I had the test, and only my son can really appreciate my vast disappointment that I'm completely European, of European origin. I was like Mr. Cobb. I wanted to retest. I thought, this can't possibly be right. So you don't always get what you want. But a lot of this is sort of how it's – part of this, Luis, is race and identity and ethnicity and nationality, they're sort of stories we tell ourselves.
Exactly. And they're I have plenty of stories to tell people that are illustrative of this thing. Some of them are kind of ridiculous. But I'm totally tempted to fall into saying that I would create a website tomorrow to compete with 23andMe that is called 14% and You. that is for stories of people who think that they have a certain identity, and when they get the DNA test from 23 or somebody else, it turns out that it is more complicated than that. And I would say that's my case. You know, I'd say, okay, I'm going to do that. A friend of mine who's a geneticist at UConn suggested I do this. And when the results came back, there were certain aspects that were surprising to me. I knew from family history that I had to have a certain percentage of European and African and maybe Native American, or as people call them sometimes, Indians and so on. But the test was kind of surprising because my percentage of Middle Eastern genes is bigger than my percentage of Native American genes. I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting to be told that there is 1% of my gene code that is Ashkenazi. And I was like, what a minute, where did that come from? Because I know that in Spain in the Middle Ages there were Sephardim Jews and so on, but Ashkenazi, that's something very interesting. But people, what happens is that, especially in Latin America, I'll speak from that point of view, because also there's a growing number of Latin Americans in this country, racial mixing has been very widespread. And in, like in the United States, there is negrophobia, there is notion of hierarchies and so on. So people over centuries passed, eventually after some generations of racial mixing, they pass into lighter categories, even including what some people call honorary whites and so on. And then the game began as this process unfolded of people not only trying to hide their identity or their heritage, but also other people trying to expose it and to make fun of this. So it became at the same time humorous, but also very politically charged at a daily life level. In fact, in Puerto Rico, there is a poem based on an expression that says, ¿Y tu abuela dónde está? And where do you keep your grandmother? You're hiding her. That's the whole tenure of the... But in the United States, I think it plays a little bit different. Because in the United States, there's this notion that white people are pure, that there was very little racial mixing. And certainly the racial mixing was not as large as in Latin America, but I think it was bigger than most people want to admit.
Great point. This won't tie it all together, but sort of back to that notion of racial identity being a social construct rather than some kind of biological reality or genetic reality. We have a third example from this week, and we'll use him to kind of round out this segment here. His name is Dave Wilson, and he is a conservative white Republican with anti-gay views, among other things. He was apparently fed up with what he called all the shenanigans at the Houston Community College system. For some reason or other, in Houston, they elect the board of trustees of their community college system as part of their municipal elections. What he did was essentially to run as an African American. Now, he didn't actually lie and say he was an African American, but his campaign website was and his flyers were decorated with all kinds of pictures of African American people. His website even has a radio ad narrated by two African American women, and he was endorsed by Ron Wilson. Now, that turns out to be his white cousin, not the black former state representative that everybody assumed would be endorsing this Dave Wilson candidate. There was never any picture of Dave Wilson, the real Dave Wilson, on any of his campaign materials, not on his website or anything like that. So it wasn't as though he absolutely lied and came right out and said that he was black. But anyway, he won by an incredibly narrow margin, 26 votes. People are stewing about it in various ways. But James, this kind of does come back to this whole notion. People make all kinds of assumptions. People thought they could read Dave Wilson. I mean, if in fact that's how he got elected, I don't think there's been enough detailed analysis of the Houston Community College Board of Trustees elections for us to really know.
I can just imagine.
Elizabeth's going to write a paper about that.
Right.
I think those things are really that's one of the things that, you know, when you get out to that level of electing the Board of Trustees, I mean, how many people really go to any great length really and actually find out whether that website really meant anything or whether it was significant? And I think that when you get in the voting booth, when you get down ballot to things like that, a lot of people either ignore it or they just check things off in a line or in a pattern or something like that. They're not really aware. I mean, there are lots of examples of strange things that got passed or strange sort of misconceptions about somebody, people who got elected because they didn't know who they were and they never had to explain themselves, or even, you know, things like uncontested elections. But I think that in this case, it's an illustration of how complicated it is, really, in a time when people look for information from things like the internet, for example. They think that everything they find out, they might go to the website, they think that that's real or they think that that's correct. And then there's further along the line, they find out that it's not true. And you've got all sorts of ramifications that come from that people speculate about that don't really mean a lot. And I'm not sure that in this case it's a really significant thing, except that in Texas there are all sorts of other underlying issues that about race, certainly, that are being intuited from it, too.
And what about the glee that the man had describing to the reporter everything that he did, including the white cousin thing, and how he had no shame, no sense of anxiety about it. He seemed very almost giggly about
it. Well, it's sort of like it's kind of like showing you how you can disrespect the political system and show how useless it is. And so it has that sort of other agenda to it.
Let me grab a call from Valentina, then I want to hear what Louise has to say about Dave Wilson as well. Hi, Valentina in Hartford. You're on the air.
Hello. I was just calling a comment. One of your speakers, I believe it was Louise, mentioned the fact that race is just so sociological and all in our heads, and an institution that is all in our heads that we've created. And just to second that and mention also that there's a book called Benign Bigotry, written by, I think, Kristen J. Anderson or Karen J. Anderson, something like that. But it discusses the psychological, sociological, and cultural aspects of race, the reactions that we have biologically and neurologically to things that we don't even that we're not aware of, and that on some level we can't control, you know, why we prefer to look at people that look like us, things like that. And so it just, I don't know, it's always interesting to me that this thing that we made up, basically, is something that has taken such hold in our society, and that's something that seems to be permanent and that we can't get rid of.
Thanks for your call, Valentina. Luis, I'll let you have the last word for this whole segment, actually. Wrap it all up for us.
Better be good.
First of all, very quickly, I could go off on this, but I'm not going to. Is that this reminded me of minstrel shows in many kinds of ways. But I just wanted to point out for the audience, and now in response more to what the caller said, there is a very prominent sociologist at Duke University, Puerto Rican scholar that I know very well, Eduardo Bonilla is his name. And he has done a lot of research and published a book about the concept of racism without racist. That is a way of having certain racial values, supremacist values, and so on, in a context that is post-civil rights era, where you're not supposed to express things in a particular kind of way. And I think that this is a very cutting-edge research that addresses a lot of the topics that we're talking about today, about subliminal, subconscious, coded ways in which people deal with these things.
All right. Great ending. We'll take a break. We'll come back with the story of Jacqueline Kennedy's pink suit. Listen to some bullet head madness that he's saying. This is way. All right, welcome back to The News. Luis Figueroa, James Hanley, and Elizabeth Kiefer are our guests today. In this segment, we're going to be talking, having a discussion at least sort of begun by an article in the New York Times today. The article says if there is a single item that captures both the shame and the violence that erupted on November 22nd, 1963, and the glamour and artifice that preceded it, it is Jackie Kennedy's blood-stained pink suit, a tantalizing window on fame and fashion, her allure and her steely resolve, the things we know about her and the things we never quite will. And it goes on to explain that basically this this suit has been preserved in the National Archives in a climate-controlled vault outside of Washington. It is subject to the Kennedy family restrictions that it not be seen for almost a century more, with the 50th anniversary coming up. Although certain people, certain curatorially skilled people and things like that have been there, have seen it. And anyway, the article, which starts on page one of today's New York Times, is kind of a long meditation on that suit and on what it can mean to people. There's a quote from it that leapt out at me that we'll get to a little bit later. But James, I'll let you sort of kick things off here. I mean, we're in the midst of this incredibly sort of Proustian trip back to November 26, 1963, with all kinds of things being used as our Madelines. And one of them, I guess, is the pink suit. But I'll just sort of let you give us your reaction.
Well, I think about the pink suit and about a lot of the other things that are kept secret. That it's just, I was thinking, reflecting on that this morning and thinking, you know, there are a lot of people who make a lot off this by keeping it secret and by keeping it somehow, you know, like forbidden, and that it's something that should be revered in secret and kept in the archives and never seen And I think that these things are really bad. I think Jackie Kennedy was a public figure. She was the first lady of an assassinated president, and everything to do with that should have been made public and obviously wasn't. And I think that the symbolic nature of keeping that dress secret and keeping it under lock and key, and also the idea that the family can prevent it from being seen for 100 years, a lot of that troubles me. I think I'm very much for actually having these things visible, that people see them, they know what happened. I think there's something very visceral about the nature of a bloodstained dress that was involved in an assassination. And I think that people need to have that conversation about things instead of recoiling from it and saying there's something iconic and special about this and that we can't handle it in some way.
One of the quotes in the article was by a curator from a different institution. She says, for that reason, combined with the fixation on President Kennedy's assassination and a changed media culture, most experts believe that displaying her suit would be problematic. Quote, it would produce hysteria if it were placed on view, said one of the people.
Well, Luis and I were talking before the show about we disagreed with that. And there's so much that's available on the internet right now that's 5,000 times more gory, let's say, than that. But autopsies, crime photos, surgeries that you can see. And I don't know if this one dress could create hysteria. And the way I looked at the dress, too, was not really about that. I'm not bothered about the family keeping that private. Brings up the whole Newtown thing about things that could maybe should be kept private. For me, it was more of a symbol of her bravery, that she draped herself over somebody knowing she could get the next bullet in the head. I see it more as a symbol of that, but not necessarily something that we all need to examine.
But I see that very idea. That's the very reason why we do need to see it, to be reminded of her, how she behaved under that circumstance, which I think a bloody dress is very indicative of exactly what happened. And I think that that gives it a veracity that people, instead of thinking of it in an abstract, this is actually the thing, if you like, that actually symbolizes the courage of this woman in actually putting herself in the way of another bullet.
I guess I'm in the place where I know it without having to see it. It reminds me of the argument I've had with people sometimes where they said, you should go see The Thin Red Line. The Thin Red Line? Yeah. What's the other one? The big one with Tom Hanks in it. The really gory war movies, because then you'll understand.
Saving Private Ryan.
And I said, I don't need, I've already read enough and examined enough to not have to see that.
Before Luis chimes in, let me just mention, if you want to be part of this conversation, and once again, these are time-limited conversations, give us a call, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the person who said this statement, this quote, is identified in the New York Times article as curator of costume and textiles at the Museum of the City of New York. That a museum curator would support keeping things not in access for research, it completely shocked me. Now, on the other hand, what I thought this morning reading this is that there are all these pictures and film footage of the Kennedy assassination, a lot of it which has been available for people to see and was fundamental part of Oliver Stone's very controversial 1991 movie, JFK. So people have seen all these very problematic pictures of Kennedy during the moment when he's shot and afterwards in the hospital or autopsy or whatever. So what is it about this particular dress? And to me, here are two things. The first one is that Jackie Kennedy is seen as a victim, the most important victim of that assassination other than the president himself. Who lost her husband, the father of her children, and who had a certain reclusive personality for many years for the rest of her life. And so I think that people feel that this would be, I think from the family and others, that this would be a violation, an attack on her innocence, on her private life, more than what it would mean for them as the children or grandchildren or whatever, or other relatives of JFK. And I think that there's something that has to do with, you know, with that aspect of who is this dress from. It's not someone else who was on that car that day. It was not from Governor Colony. I think that was the name of the other person there. It's from her.
But the thing that bothers me, though, is that somebody is making a decision about something so fundamental that is ultimately public. And the fact is that, yes, Jackie Kennedy and John F. Kennedy had a private life, but they were both public figures. And this was a huge public event, the assassination. And that makes it different. And I think that when public events occur, when there's an attack in public, when there is a whole question about what happened and so on. I mean, for example, you look at the films of the actual assassination taking place. Those were taken in a very sort of fuzzy 8mm films and very low quality pictures. And so it left lots of room for speculation. That's one example. But there's also the nature of all of the other artifacts, the dress included. I mean, you don't have to go and see the dress if it's put on display, if it disturbs you and you don't want to see it. But the fact that it is available to the public is an important public statement about when you take on public life and something happens, somebody attacks you or something happens. And I think that Newtown is another example of this. Yes, I sympathize with, you know, the families who were involved. But nevertheless, the response of public responders, the police and the emergency facilities, we need to hear things. We need to see things. We need to know these things, or at least know that they are available, that we can go into an archive and we can actually see it and we can know this is what happened. I mean, if you don't have that, there are so many things that can be kept secret. I mean, take it as far as the Holocaust. When all the Holocaust victims are dead, then it's going to be possible to create a scenario if you don't have some ability to see the documents and see the artifacts, see the shoes, see the hair and the teeth and the horrible things that were done.
You know, and I think that is, you know, I don't think that this dress should be the first thing that you see when you walk into some, or suit. It should not be the first thing you see when you walk into some kind of museum. As you say, it ought to be inspectable maybe under certain circumstances. And I think the larger question, there's two larger questions for me. One of them is, yeah, just as you say, James, really when you think about what most of us do when we travel, most of us spend a certain amount of time when we travel anywhere trying to make part of the history of that area real by going to museums. I was in Amsterdam this summer and I spent some time at the Resistance Museum, and at a certain point, seeing these actual artifacts, things become less abstract and more real to us. And that's one of the reasons we look at these things as opposed to simply think about them. But the other part of this too is, and I've just noticed this in this deluge that we're in right now of 50-year retrospectives on the assassination. You suddenly realize, first of all, that the craziness of that day has never completely gone away. And part of it is because the information has kind of trickled out slowly. Some of it was available right away, some of it later. Just the way that it was all presented to the public, there's never been a comprehensive level of satisfaction that people understand that day. And the more information that you do have – now, I did watch this week a thing on Nova where they were doing all kinds of ballistic reconstructions of the day. And I had a couple of reactions. One of them was that there were some photos that I wound up seeing that I guess have become part of the public record that I'd never seen before that were quite gruesome and disturbing of the president. On the other hand, the whole thing was ultimately kind of helpful to me. By the end of the special, I was beginning to think, you know, this is getting a little boring, as opposed to being kind of murky and fascinating and lurid and you know, and provocative to me. It was the more that I knew, the more I thought, all right, this really – I understand this better, and it's maybe not even as – full of skullduggery as Oliver Stone or anybody wanted me to think that it was. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, I was surprised when I read the article that this dress was not part of the forensic evidence that the Warren Commission examined, in which case this issue would not be present because it would be part of the forensic evidence of the Warren Commission, which it should have been, it seems to me. And so they would be part of the Warren Commission documents that were and objects that were released, like you say, trigger by trigger, a bunch of them after JFK's movie by Oliver Stone. But I also want to remind people that this week, maybe this was on the radar for most people, an issue that came up in the news was that John Kerry said that he is one of those people who believes that someone beyond Lee Harvey Oswald was also involved in the assassination. In other words, that the theory that the Warren Commission came up with, that he acted alone, he doesn't accept it, that he believes that there were more people. Therefore, if there are at least one more person, that means that there was a conspiracy. And he was asked by journalists recently, a few days ago, and he refused to elaborate. And so what that brought up was, again, these controversies and the way this has been handled. As a historian, as you can imagine, I would prefer that all these things and other kinds of documents are available. I suffer from this during my research because there is a family in Puerto Rico that has enormous amount of documentation on the 19th century that I wanted to use, and they don't let me use it, in part because they learned that I had uncovered a family secret that had to do with race. So, but this, it's unbelievable that we continue to have these that probably should be public records.
Well, that also goes to the heart of the nature of what are public records. And, for example, in the Kennedy assassination, the autopsy, the original autopsy report was burned by the doctor who conducted it because he thought that it might fall into the wrong hands or whatever, that you know, this was the blood-stained original document that might actually have been a central piece of evidence. But he made that decision to do that, and he made that decision because there wasn't an expectation about the behavior regarding public records, that they would be public records, and you can't do that. And that is what we deal with now with things that, for instance, okay, well, somebody somewhere decides, oh, this is too traumatic for us to hear, or it's going to upset the family, and then it gets put away, and who knows what happens to it. And so we then have to deal with all of the speculation that is attendant on that as to what it actually meant. And that can go on for years, as it has done with the Kennedy assassination.
All right. We're going to have to take a pause here. I want to make sure we have time for endorsements. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
Movie 8 till the wedding day. Shots rang out. The police came. Mama laid me on the front lawn and prayed for Jackie's strength.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our intern, Corey Breen. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bruce Dern. On Monday, a show about the best stories of the weekend. For more stories, links, and photos of the staff of the Faith Middleton Show partying hard with Rob Ford, check our website, WNPR.org. And now, back to the nose.
All right, so we're going to do endorsements in just a second. Before we do endorsements, we'll do anything that's sort of coming up on the calendar. James and I want to tell you about something Saturday night from 6 to 10 p.m. at Trinity Cine Studio. There'll be a fundraising, the annual fundraising gala or gala, depending. I think you're allowed to go to either. There's a reception, there's prizes, and there's a screening of the newly restored Mel Brooks comedy masterpiece, Young Frankenstein. I will be your MC. I'm not quite sure what that entails, but whatever it is, I'll do it. James, how do they get tickets to this?
Oh, well, they can go online. You can still buy tickets today at brownpapertickets.com, but we'll have tickets at the door as well. And if you get the tickets in advance, it's just a will call. You just come to the box office. And we have a big crowd there, and we have great food and very great enthusiasm for cinema. And it's an opportunity also for people to talk back to us and tell us their experiences at Cine Studio and ask questions and generally have a good time.
And there's a silent auction, all that good stuff. So come on out. That's Saturday night. Tickets are still available. I would be plugging Peter and the Wolf at the Jorgensen, which I'm narrating the next day, but it seems to be sold out. So on to endorsements. Elizabeth Kiefer, what have you got for us?
Well, as you know, a few months back, I decided to leave after 7.5 years in the Farmington Valley. I decided to leave, and I did research all of Connecticut. I wanted to make sure I could get to the college in an appropriate amount of time. And looked at shore towns and decided to move back to a place I'd already lived in a number of times, which is West Hartford. And I want to endorse West Hartford because for a number of reasons. One is I love the diversity of the town, and Farmington Valley doesn't have that, and I was missing that. And also, West Hartford is one of the few towns, really probably in America, I don't think I'm exaggerating, there aren't that many, that is truly walkable, where you can walk to everything. I meet people out. I walk to Whole Foods. I walk into the center to have whatever, a latte. And the Reservoir, which is a priceless gem that we have. So I just want to endorse West Hartford.
All right. If you're going to get your latte, get it at Cafe Sofia.
Okay.
Big fans of Cafe Sofia. Yeah. And my son and I have a Saturday morning routine. We're like two old men. Do the same thing every Saturday
terrific
morning.
Terrific crepes also there.
Yeah, we get a breakfast crepe and lattes at Cafe Sofia. It's part of our Saturday morning morning routine. James, what would you like to endorse?
Kind of a thing about local food. And first of all, to thank the farmers of the summer who have been at the farm markets. It has made such a wonderful difference to Connecticut, the fact that you can get fresh food direct from the farm, talk to the farmers. And they've worked so hard this summer. And the Coventry Market and the Storrs Farm Market are the two that we go to that are really incredible. And amazingly, they're going to be running in the winter as well. I think there's a pop-up market for the Coventry Market on Tuesday, the 26th as well. But also I wanted to link that to a sort of local food movement, and also the fact I live near Willimantic, and Willimantic Main Street, which is a sort of classic old Main Street of Connecticut that has been down at heel for a long time, is really coming alive with places like Cafe Mantic and Jamaican Me Crazy and lots of interesting places to go. And it's wonderful.
I would say also, as the winter goes along here, we'll try to give you more information a little about winter farmers markets. But yes, Coventry will come back. It goes indoors into the high school. And there's a pop-up coming up at Goodwin College on that Tuesday. I don't know the details of that yet, but we'll try to get you information about that. And you New Haven listeners know that there are farmers markets down there, including the one on Worcester Square, which, as far as I know, just sort of keeps rolling through the winter. So when things stop, there's also one on Saturday mornings through December, I think, in West Harford Center. But in New Haven, when things dry up around here, my son and I do go down to New Haven and have another boring old man ritual down there. Luis, what have you got?
I want to endorse very strongly a book that was published this fall. The author's name is Dory Katz. The book is titled Looking for Strangers, The True Story of My Hidden Wartime Childhood. This is a memoir of a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Belgium who, for many years in her life, for a long time in her life, she thought that she had lost all the memories of her childhood during World War II and immediately after World War II. Her father perished in the Holocaust in Auschwitz, and her mother in 1943 gave her, when she was like three or so, gave her to a Catholic family in Belgium to be hidden from the Nazis. And after the war, she was given to an orphanage, and eventually she ended up in America. But she tried for years to connect with those memories. The book also deals with her troubled relationship with her mother and her eventual trip back to Belgium to reconnect with the people back from that time. I strongly recommend it. It's very beautifully written. It's very worth taking a look at it.
My endorsements are, first of all, something that you can see on television. I think you have to have HBO to do it. It's called Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight. It's a 2013, this year, film directed by Stephen Frears, who's a terrific director. It's a recreation of the Supreme Court battle over Muhammad Ali's draft status. It has spectacular performances, especially by Christopher Plummer, who seems to be hell-bent on doing like seven or eight really great performances here sort of towards the home stretch of his life. Mm. He keeps doing terrific things. He plays John Harlan, who played a very problematic and sort of tippy role in this that I knew nothing about. This is all based on a book about this Supreme Court case. But really, there are all kinds of fabulous actors. Frank Langella plays Warren Berger, and Danny Glover plays Chief Justice Thurgood Marshall. Justice Thurgood Marshall. Peter Garrity, you may know from The Wire, plays William Brennan. Harris Yulin plays William O. Douglas. These are just fabulous performances and a great kind of recreation of a Supreme Court battle. Ed Begley is Harry Blackmun. It's a terrific movie. It's really interesting, and it's interspersed. Nobody plays Muhammad Ali. Instead, it's interspersed with actual clips of Muhammad Ali talking on various talk shows and giving speeches about the situation he's in, and also a reminder of what a riveting presence he was. I'm also going to endorse, you have just a few days left to go down and see this. It's called Snapshots, a musical scrapbook. It's at the Norma Terrace Theater in Chester. I saw it last weekend. It's a compilation of the music of Stephen Schwartz. You know Stephen Schwartz from the shows Wicked, Pippin, Godspell, and possibly The Baker's Wife, although that one is fairly obscure. But there are more songs than this. They're stitched together in a review that has a little bit of a plot, a really fabulous six-member cast who are kind of diving in and out of different roles. All of them play the same roles and different roles. They're exchanging parts all the time. The use of the music is really innovative, too, and the way that they kind of stitch a whole series of unrelated songs together to make kind of a story I found very affecting. So you've got until Sunday to see that. It's right at the end of its run. It's at the Norma Terrace Theater in Chester. You can also, of course, get a pretty good meal in Chester at some of those restaurants right beforehand.
In conclusion, as Kyone Wolf, Toronto's acting mayor, I'm just going to get right to work doing whatever I have to do. And if that includes on some smoking some while asphyxiating on my own in the back room of a Victoria's Secret, that's what I'm prepared to do. That's all. Thank you. No more questions.